House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is the 26th of February. I apologize for the late start. We were tied up on the floor. We were hearing three bills today. We were carrying them all over to tomorrow. We're not going to work any of the bills today. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1562. Call Senator Taylor, Representative Stark, and Representative Salinas, if she's here.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 1562 and was brought to you by Senator Taylor. Senate Bill 1562A adds knowingly impeding the normal breathing or circulation of another person by applying pressure to the chest of the other person to the offense of strangulation. It also increases the penalty for this offense when the victim is a family or household member to a Class C felony, and it directs the Criminal Justice Commission to classify all felony-level strangulations to a crime category 5. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Chair Barker. Before I start with my prepared remarks, Senator Steiner Hayward is intending to testify. She's in another committee right now, so hopefully if she can't be here right at the beginning, if you could please call her up later. And then Representative Salinas, I think, is in the same position, but I'm not certain. Also, before I go on, I want to draw attention to the fact that when this bill was heard in Senate Judiciary in front of Chair Pozanski, we had several survivors of domestic violence, of strangulation in particular, come and give testimony. Some of the members of the committee I know heard about that secondhand. It was one of the most disturbing hearings, at least in my short time in the legislature, I've ever sat through. And I chose to not ask some. There, we have some other folks. A lot of people will be here testifying, but some of the testimony was extremely upsetting, and so we didn't have them come back and testify again. I really, really, this is the one time I've never asked any committee member to look at that testimony. Please look at that testimony before tomorrow. It's really something that you need to see to hear these women's stories of what happened to them in the act of strangulation. So I see that Representative Salinas is here, so I'll go ahead and start with my prepared remarks. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, and Vice Chair Olson, I see that he must be otherwise occupied.
Yeah.
Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Senator, District 21. I'm here today to urge your support for Senate Bill 1562A, a bill that makes a common sense update to our statute surrounding the crime of strangulation. First, the bill updates the definition of strangulation to include pressure on the chest to acknowledge the many ways someone may try to restrict the blood or oxygen flow to the brain. The bill also adds the strangulation of a, quote, family or household member to the instances in which the crime is classified as a felony. By adding family or household members to the category of felonious strangulation, we are ensuring that strangulation in the context of intimate partner violence is given the serious consideration it deserves. Colleagues, it is well known that domestic violence is not an issue of anger management or lack of control. It's about power and control. Abusers use a variety of tactics to gain power and control over their partner. Among those tactics of abuse is physical abuse, and one of the most extreme forms of physical abuse is strangulation. Strangulation carries an inherent and well-documented risk of lethality within the context of domestic violence. When someone is strangled, loss of consciousness can happen in seconds, and death within minutes. According to the Journal of Emergency Medicine, if an abuser strangles their partner, it is more than 7 times more likely that the relationship will turn lethal. I'm going to say that again. It is more than 7 times likely that the relationship will turn lethal. Additionally, a study of female homicides from 1994 to 2000 found that 56% of female homicide victims experienced a previous strangulation incident by their partners. When an abuser is capable of strangling their partner, they are communicating the extreme lengths they are willing to go to remain in control, and they are reinforcing the fear a victim has of leaving the relationship or confronting the abuse. It is well known that for a variety of reasons, survivors of violence may minimize their abuse, and that is also true about this extreme form of violence. Designating this crime appropriately as a felony will lessen minimization from victims, law enforcement, medical professionals, and anyone who is a survivor of abusers may reach out to them to confide in. It takes very little physical effort or time to severely injure or murder someone through the act of strangulation. Serious life-threatening injuries can take place even if no mark is left on the neck or chest. We also know that those who have been strangled by their partner have been strangled more than 5 times on average. I'm sure the committee can recognize that I am passionate about this issue, and I brought this bill forward in consultation with a variety of experts, specifically domestic violence advocates who are incredibly knowledgeable on the statistics and the risks, and have also heard firsthand experiences with individuals who have experienced this terrifying crime. The Association of Oregon Counties, the District Attorneys Association, sheriffs and chiefs and sheriffs, and many more have voiced their support for this bill currently written. We did not come to the details of this bill lightly. We worked closely with the Criminal Justice Commission and Parole and Probation to take a very positive step forward, categorizing this as a felony, achieving consistency across sentencing for felony strangulation, and communicating how serious this crime is within the very frustrating realities of our budget limitations. While strangulation is always serious, We chose to focus in on the strangulation and the context of domestic violence because the motivating factors of the perpetrator are very different than when strangulation occurs in other types of assault. As I've stated, it is within the context that the risk of lethality skyrockets. We know it's happening to the victim multiple times. We know it is done in order to keep someone under control, to put profound fear in their victim. I'm going to go ahead and turn this over, obviously, to my colleagues, but also to the experts with experience working on these issues who will be able to help as well with questions. Today, we have an opportunity to categorize this crime in a way that reflects its critical and life-threatening nature, which 30 states before us have already done. I appreciate the broad bipartisan stakeholder support for this bill, which passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee and off the Senate floor unanimously. I urge your support for Senate Bill 1562A. I'm not sure if Dr. Steiner Hayward, she's not here yet. You'll see, as I ask everyone to look on OLAS to see the Senate hearing, Dr. Steiner Hayward has given me permission to share with all of you, I mean, you'll see it in her remarks, that she is a survivor of domestic violence, and she herself was strangled in her relationship, and she hopefully will be able to make it over here to share her personal story. So I'm going to stop for the time being and turn it over to Representative Stark, or Representative Salinas.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the representative for House District 38, Southwest Portland and Lake Oswego. And thank you to my co-chief sponsors for being here and setting up the issue so nicely. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 1562A. And as Senator Taylor said, statistically speaking, those who commit the crime of strangulation in a domestic violence setting are very likely to commit much more serious crimes, including the possibility of eventually killing their spouse and others, such as police officers. Moreover, strangulation is often committed amidst several other crimes related to domestic violence, like those of assault and battery. And perpetrators are often not charged with the crime, as it's often dropped as part of a plea deal. Increasing the penalties for strangulation will help increase conviction rates for the serious crime, which will help lower the rates by which perpetrators commit both the crime of strangulation as well as far more heinous crimes. I urge your support of SB 1562A, and you'll hear very compelling testimony after me. I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative in Southern Oregon, here to in support, obviously, of Senate Bill 1562. And, you know, people are going to, will be speaking much more eloquently about the details of this bill and some of the negotiations that got us to the bill in its current form. I wanted to really just remark on a couple issues. Why expand it to include pressure on the chest? And for me, this is a fairly personal thing, as my wife and I, throughout our lives, have worked in a variety of settings with women and children. My wife is a professional counselor. I used to work in psychiatric rehab for troubled youth. And then, and even with the foster children that we take in, the number of stories that we hear. But one story comes to mind specifically of a young boy who confided in me that what was happening is, as Senator Taylor shared, strangulation is not necessarily an impulse thing. It's about power and control, as is most domestic violence. And so And that means that people sometimes think about what they're going to do. Instead of just acting in a fit of rage and hitting someone, they actually have opportunities to think through, you know, what am I going to do next time? How am I going to control this? How am I going to get away with this? How am I going to explain this? And the thing about strangling someone at the neck is it leaves marks. But this young boy, his father, had discovered that if he applied the pressure of his forearm on his chest, that it wouldn't leave marks. And so day after day, year after year, what this man would do is he would lean on this young boy. He would put his forearm right in the middle of his chest. And he would describe to me how he would just stare him in the eyes, unrelenting, and watch his breath be taken from him where he could barely move. He couldn't speak. He couldn't respond. He couldn't cry. Nothing. And this man would do this to his child year after year after year. And get away with it because it didn't leave marks. I think it's time for us to state to the public that that's just as serious as leaving the marks, because the internal marks that it leaves is just as serious. And so when we think about this categorized with domestic violence as opposed to a strangling someone, it is different. You know, there's a professor out of U of O that wrote a great book called Betrayal Trauma about when you are trapped in an abusive situation that you can't escape, and the deep trauma that gives you as opposed to a one-time tragedy. It's a fascinating study. It's a sad study. But it is at a different level, and it's at a level that I think that we need to take serious at a felony level. Now, I'm no stranger to the fact that we have to figure out how to pay for our decisions. And so there are those here today who I think would like to talk about, you know, the whole, where are we classifying different things? Our original bill that we put forward included, you know, a classification that would cost some money for, you know, and we, in order to try to come up with a solution that didn't have a fiscal, because we last session voted unanimously in this committee to send an almost identical bill on, and it had a price tag. And I can't help but think that because it had a price tag, that we were putting a price on the safety of people, and therefore we set it aside and didn't act on it. Year after year, we've done that. Each time we show that it costs money, we do nothing. And so it was a backup plan that the legislators said, well, how can we figure out a way to still increase accountability so that we decrease this happening to people, but have it not cost money? And that's where someone will talk about in just a little bit, that whole idea about the level 6 classification being bumped down to a level 5 and misdemeanors up to a level 5 as opposed to a 4. That's not the desire. The desire is to make sure that we have a way to do something so we can put a stop to this. We can hold people accountable, and we can have children and women and men and people who are in these relationships be safe. So it's not about the money. It's not even about the classification. It's about us actually responding in a way that we can. And so quite frankly, if we could keep it at a level 6 and pay for it and guarantee that it went through the building, by all means, let's do it. But I've yet to see it make it out of Ways and Means. And that's my fear if we do that today. I'm willing to take questions. There are smarter people on this topic that can give you the details, but we're open.
Thank you, panel, and appreciate the fact that you didn't have to bring all those witnesses back through again today.
Chair Barker, if I may, thank you, and thank you for, I should have thanked you, because I obviously had to check with you that I did not have to bring back everyone who testified last time, so thank you for doing that. I also wanted to point out that Senator Prezansky, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is here if anybody wants, if anybody has any questions about how we ended up where we were at. Senator Prezansky and I worked very closely on this together, and that is why we have this, the bill in the form that we have today with the changes that occur. It was a well thought out decision, and yes, finances are part of it, but that is our responsibility to try to come up with a bill and a package that takes into account the finances behind it. So just wanted to
and I want to especially thank all of you for all the hard work you've done getting this bill to us. We've had this bill several times, and it hasn't made it out of the building. So thank you again. And thank you, Senator. We'll have you up in a few minutes, Senator. Representative Parrish, you want to come on up?
Good Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland Tualatin. And I hate to come and say that I am opposed to a bill about strangulation, but I am because of the sentencing reduction piece. And Mr. Chair, you and I are the only two people sitting here besides the good senator who were here in 2011 when on a very late day in June, we passed a bill, House Bill 2940, that increased for certain instances of strangulation the penalty from a misdemeanor to a felony for strangulation. It had been through a process whereby we were tied that year, and we decided that we would appropriate money as a bipartisan legislature, nearly $5 million in an appropriation, because at the time, the data said that we would see an increase in sentencing of about 250 people per year if we made the jump from a misdemeanor to a felony for circumstances when it's witnessed by a child, when the victim is under 10 years old, when it involves a deadly dangerous weapon. So that could include something like a belt wrapped around somebody's neck and used to choke the life out of somebody. We know the statistics, and you heard all of the good reasons why we need to make sure we send a message to the public that strangulation is not a crime that we tolerate here in Oregon. But sending that message also means not reducing sentencing on a bill that we passed in 2011. And I went through and sort of hand transcribed some testimony, but Mr. Speaker, with your indulgence, I don't say it as well as one of our former colleagues. Would you mind giving me a few minutes for some audio?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I too was shocked when I joined here in Salem that strangulation is not—
I'm gonna break in for 1 second. If you can keep it really down, different voices carry better, and if you are quiet, it makes us—
Senator Roblin, chairing, and it's Representative Katie Ayer.
Thank you again, Mr. Speaker. I was shocked that strangulation was not a felony. Who knew? Who would have thought? And it is one of the most personal types of violence enacted on another human being. Colleagues, I want to thank each one of you who has brought it to this point to finally allow it to even get to a floor vote. There were many people who changed their minds to get it here, many people who jumped on board, many people who worked very hard to push this here and to do what's right for Oregonians. I want to walk you through the very personal nature of strangulation. Again, among the most personal types of crime that can ever be put on another human being. Strangulation has one of two goals in mind by the person perpetrating it. One is power and control over their victim, and the second is potential death. Neither one of them is anything that we as a legislature can support. Strangulation is done. It is a crime that takes more than a moment. A shotgun is at a distance, far distance, in a moment. A stabbing is momentarily. A punch is momentarily. But strangulation requires their victim to be at arm's length or closer. One or two hands applied to the neck of their victim if they don't use another weapon. And they must sustain it for more than a moment. They must keep that increasing pressure around the neck of their victim. All for power and control or death, to remove the very air from that person, to make that person struggle vehemently for one more gasp of air. Strangulation is awful. It is not a crime of passion. Abusers out there use crime of passion as their defense. My goodness, abusers can control their temper in almost every other relationship in their life, with their employer, with retail clerks, going to the gas station, often with their children, often not, with their family members, often, sometimes not. But they have control, but they choose not to exert control over their own persons when it comes to their victim. And they seek power and control over their victim through strangulation. It's a deterrence tool that we can provide our law enforcement and our courts to stop domestic violence, to stop sexual assault, to stop perpetuation of victimization. We can allow that. We can give them a tool, and let's do that. Let me just say one more thing. If someone is willing to remove the very air from another human being, I have little mercy on that person. very little. It's a felony and nothing short of heinous. And let's give victims like Diana back her power and control. We as a legislature can do that. I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you for the indulgence on that, because she said it so well. And it's one of those floor speeches, when you've been here for a long time, there are ones that you remember. And that was one, and a day that I remember, because Representative Ayer had certainly experienced domestic violence at different points in time in her life. It was a bill, when we brought 2940, the purpose of that was to make sure, and with the funding, Mr. Chair, that we were going to send a message, a true message, to Oregonians that strangulation is not something we tolerate. So to me, when I see a bill, after it took three legislative sessions prior to get to House Bill 2940, to see us wind a piece of that back, even some people think is a small way, I'm going to have to be opposed to that. You know, on the sentencing schedule, one of my concerns is that in the reduction of prison time to county jail time, my counties, Mr. Chair, are doing forced releases every single day. In Clackamas County, 250 to 300 forced releases a month out of the county jail. On the Washington County side of my district, it is one forced release a day. So every time we pass legislation that says 364 days or we reduce sentencing scheduling, it is putting an unfunded mandate on our county. These are not the type of people that we want back in our streets. And I have no assurances from either of my counties that somebody who has committed the act of strangulation won't come out of the county jail if they're not in prison on a forced release. So for that reason, I'm going to urge that we have a very robust conversation in what little time is left of this legislative session. There is a dash 18 that would make all categories of strangulation a felony offense, period. And that we stop sort of biting around the apple and including little pieces into the law. We know strangulation is bad. So let's take it on full tilt. And you know, we do prioritize our spending here. Mr. Chair, there are things down in Ways and Means right now that are wants and not needs. I would say keeping people who are willing to commit that type of crime on another human being, to take the very air out of their lungs, that they do not get to have any kind of reduced sentencing, period, and that we have an obligation to keep the public safe, and that means spending on things like public safety and maybe not funding some of the wants that are sitting down in Ways and Means. Let's fund our needs first. Thank you.
Thank you. I would point out, I've talked to some of the district attorneys, and they said on the more serious crimes, those that would be a six that in this bill are down to a five, they would charge additional charges so that the people would be, in those cases, probably would still be going to the penitentiary.
And Mr. Chair, I've heard some of that too, but you know, we do know that that doesn't always work out that way.
And as far as a mandate to the counties, every time we create any misdemeanor laws, we do that as well.
Yeah, I agree. Questions? Appreciate that.
Yes, if you may. So the testimony that you just provided us via audio, to me, did not sound substantively different at all from what Senator Taylor just presented. So I guess I'm a little confused around what that was supposed to add to the conversation if the bill that you were discussing that was passed earlier has not solved the problem. Senator Taylor and some of our colleagues are working to build off of that to address the problem further. So I'm sort of not understanding why you would be opposed to the current bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Power, I'm opposed to the current bill because the current bill reduces the sentencing. It takes it down to a different class of sentencing, which means less prison time potentially or less jail time potentially for a crime we all agree is a pretty heinous crime. And so the speech that I shared, the historical perspective of how hard it was to get what we got, to take that back, even when we all agree to reduce that sentencing down, I don't think is good public policy.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Thank
you.
Appreciate it. Senator Prozanski, did you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Floyd Prozanski, State Senator, District 4, represents parts of Lane and Douglas counties. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here today to give maybe some references on Senate Bill 1562A as it passed through our committee. I think for as a starting point, what we have to do is look at what the current law is. And unfortunately, the representative who just gave testimony may not realize that what was passed back in 2940 actually set up a scenario that it takes predicates, it takes required other situations to occur before you get to a felony level. And so in a situation, as if you have an individual that is the offender who is a strangler, and if he or she is a person who strangles three separate distinct people, it's the fourth one that would get them to a felony level six. It takes three prior strangulations to get to a felony. So one of the things that we looked at on the Senate side is, how can we fix that? What can we do to actually ensure that individuals that are involved in this type of crime is going to be held accountable and they will see incarceration? So what we did is we had the Criminal Justice Commission run various options as to how we might be able to look at different scenarios, what levels it could be. First of all, this bill, as the representative mistaken again, will in fact have everybody who has committed this crime and that's convicted as a felony. They will all be Class C felons. The question is, inside that internal working, besides being a Class C felon, how do they rank on the crime seriousness list? What category do they go into? And so when you, again, look at the current bill, you have to have these predicates to get to a Class C felony. And under the original bill as it came in, it was going to set up a bifurcated process. It was going to maintain what we currently has as the level six with the predicates. And then for those who are misdemeanors, they're going to be bumped up to a level four. Again, it's going to be a Class C felony, but it will be even lower. And this is a part then when you start looking at, what does that mean? What is the difference between a level four, level five, and level six? These individuals would be coming in under the D category. And so as a level four, they would be below the line presumptive probation, meaning no jail. Presumptive probation, I mean, they could get jailed, don't get me wrong on that. But they would not be incarcerated to a specific amount of time. And then there's a limitation of how much time they can actually get based on the spread of 60 days in custody units and then up to 120. And those are days. So under the D, with the class six right now, it's 13 to 14 months. As a class five, it's 9 to 10 months, but it is time and it's above the line, and so it's presumed that they are going to be doing this jail time. As the chair has said, there are multiple ways that a prosecutor can take a particular case on a case-by-case basis and charge additional offenses. And also, even under this own offense, there are things what we know as aggravating and mitigating factors. And when you look at the aggravating factors that are available to a prosecutor to bring forward, they can actually go through and show and demonstrate that the type of offense is very serious. And I'm looking for my little sheet here, and it looks like it's not right. I'm not seeing it on this one. This is a new form that someone just gave to me. Oh, here they are. Aggravating factors. Deliberately cruel. Vulnerability of the victim. Threat of actual violence. Persistence, involvement in unrelated current crime. So you have aggravating factors that a court can take under consideration, even as it's charged, and give an enhanced sentence, meaning above and beyond what is called for in the guidelines. Now, what I think is important is what we are attempting to do is, knowing because of the restrictions we've had previously on the revenue and ability to fund across the board, this legislature has, in fact, gone in and restructured sentences on multiple occasions. One that I would point out to you was in 2013, was House Bill 3194, significant changes in our sentencing, and we restructured and readjusted it so we could actually ensure certain type of offenses could be held more accountable. And that's what we're doing here. So what you have before you now in the bill as it's currently stands, 1562A, is that we would have all of these type of felonies, domestic violence, strangulations, go in as a level five, as it all would be a Class C felony, and then this would be a level five, and we wouldn't have this disparity. And that is one of the things we heard in our testimony from one of the prosecutors, was that if we went forward with the original bill, we will need to be coming back at some point because there could be an argument of not having the parity between the type of sentences for the same type of conduct. So what we looked at is how can we match all this up? How can we ensure that we can hold people accountable on the first incident as a felony? And we came up with a level five. Ironically, through the work that CJC provided to us, it's revenue neutral. So we are guaranteed that we are going to be able to move this bill as it is currently written through this process, and it will, in fact, be able to go make it through any review with, well, at this point, it does not even have to go through Ways and Means because we already have checked on it, and based on it being revenue neutral, if you pass this as is out of this committee to the floor and it passes on the floor, it's law. And at that point, anyone who is involved in a domestic violence strangulation will be faced with a Class C felony. And it's not tearing up or stepping down. It's all going to be the same. And it will be, I would say, a better approach for us as prosecutors to be able to actually have the same parameters for these type of individuals that are involved in this type of conduct. So, Mr. Chair, I know that there may be some other questions. I understand from what you said at the beginning that you're not going to be working the bill today. If it's something that you'd like for me to make time for my schedule tomorrow, please let me know. I'll be glad to come in when you're doing your work session. I'm also available to any of the members offline if that would help them going through any of the materials that you might have questions about. And if you have questions now, I'll do my best to answer them.
Anybody have any questions for Senator? Thank you very much for the explanation. Very good clarification. Okay, next we'll call Ms. D, Jennifer Snippen, and Sarah Van Dyke. Okay, you go in any order, but just identify yourself for the record by your name.
Shall I start? Members of the committee, I am using my name, Ms. D, because I legally changed my name after the last divorce. I am a victim of domestic violence that included smothering, which in the state of Washington is considered strangulation. I'm learning. I live in Hood River County. I had to relocate there. I have seen the man who attacked me at Starbucks, so I can't go in that neighborhood and hang out anymore. So I would like to discuss with you the my support for making strangulation, including smothering and pressure to the chest, a felony, because from my experience, it is attempted murder. And in my last case, my last marriage ended 2 years ago, which is when the attack happened. It spilled over to my workplace and my family. And as I said, with my community, my girlfriends don't go to that Starbucks anymore either. So I'm not very professional at this, and I don't understand exactly how this this bill is being presented. But when I was attacked in Clark County, my ex used a down comforter to cover my face while he pressed 275 pounds of adrenaline on top of me. And he, I consider him borderline personality disorder. He thought I was cheating with a coworker. I was not. I had only been married to him for 2 months before I moved out. And this incident happened within 2 weeks after I filed for divorce. And I went back to get my bed. I didn't think he was in the apartment, and he picked me up and threw me down, covered me with his body and the down comforter, and kept covering my entire face, and I would struggle, and he continued to do that and said, "Tell me you're cheating, tell me you're having sex." Until I lied and said that, that's when he uncovered me. And then he started up again with covering me again until I made up some address of where my coworker lived. I got out of that situation that particular night. It took, because he had told me if I ever told the police, he would hurt or kill my family. I have 6 grandchildren. I have a 76-year-old mother, and now my 7-year-old granddaughter, who was close to this individual, knows that she needs to report it immediately when he comes on the playground. Excuse me. I want to point out that he did 7 months of time. I was not his first, I was probably his first victim that reported domestic violence, but he had a conviction of stalking in Multnomah County, and when he was with me, he was on parole. I didn't understand what stalking meant, even though I did a background check on him. Nothing violent came out. I've since learned quite a bit. But when he did 7 months in Clark County, he was transferred back to Multnomah County. And he he's still on parole, but within 6 weeks, he attacked his mother, who at the time was 66 years old, and he had charges of strangulation in Clackamas County. He did 7 weeks. And when I called Clackamas County and pointed out that I was a previous victim, and would that affect his case, would that affect his the sentencing that he could have in Oregon, they said it really didn't matter. And that was extremely disturbing for one. She's elderly. I was not in touch with that family anymore because I have had to go incognito, but it really is disturbing that he only had to do 7 weeks, and it was considered a misdemeanor. And my example shows where it spilled over to the community because he had, 2 days after he attacked me, he called and threatened my coworker. The company I work for has been professional. They value me. I am still working there, but immediately after he was released from Clark County, my company had to pay for a security guard to monitor our property front and back. They paid 3 weeks for a private security guard.
And Mrs. D, I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt you, and we really appreciate your story, but we have a lot of other
okay.
people, and we're limited in time, so we could summarize. And I really appreciate you coming in, and I hate to tell you this.
No, that's fine. Okay. I appreciate that. But my point is, I really would like to see this. It's not just me that's affected. It's my children, my family, the community, my company. And I'd really like to see it made. And that particular individual's behavior won't change until there's a stricter sentence.
Thank you so much for coming in today. Really appreciate it. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Van Dyke. I'm the Domestic Violence Systems Coordinator in Clackamas County, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1562A. You have my written testimony, so I'm just going to summarize it very quickly
since
we have a lot going on.
Yeah.
Clackamas County is committed to the safety and security of its citizens through legislation that improves the response for survivors of domestic violence and improved accountability for offenders. We consider strangulation to be a serious public health issue that directly affects the well-being of survivors, families, first responders, and the community as a whole. Strangulation has a serious health implications for those who strangled, and in addition, it affects the places strangulation affects places, and I'm sorry, affects the entire community and puts that at risk. Because we understand these realities, Clackamas County is investing resources to improve our coordinated response to strangulation. We urge a yes vote on Senate Bill 1562A.
Thank you very much. Yep.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and committee members. My name is Jennifer Snippen. I live in Linn County. I've been a nurse for over 20 years, and the majority of my early formative years, I was a neurotrauma critical care nurse. And the last 10 to 15 years, I've been a board certified medical legal death investigator. And I've also worked in corrections as a nurse, and I teach anatomy and physiology at a college level. And I just want to very briefly speak to you in support of anything that elevates this crime to a felony. In any instance that we can. I've seen what the loss of oxygen to the brain can do. I see the devastating effects on patients. I've seen the loss of control, what that does to families and victims. And I've seen the individuals that actually perpetrate this crime, and they're a different class of bad people. Anybody who's willing to put their hands on somebody else's neck or stop somebody from breathing is a different class of dangerous. And so I just very briefly want to support this bill and answer any questions you might have of me.
Thank you very much for coming in your testimony. Really appreciate it. Senator Haven, do you want to get you in and out? I know you're busy today. Thank you for coming over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate District 17. And I'll try to be brief, although I'll freely admit that when I testified in Senate Judiciary, this got a little tough for me. On the medical side, I just want to reiterate what the previous witness said about the medical effects of anything that causes loss of oxygen. Hypoxia, which is the technical term for insufficient oxygen, leads to the death of brain cells in just minutes. And even temporary and reversed hypoxia of just a few minutes can lead to inexorable cell death in the brain. And over time, with repeated incidents like this, as perpetrators of domestic violence are known to do, because this is a control mechanism. This is not about lack of control. My husband was a police officer for a while, and when he was called to a domestic assault, he used to say to people, to the perpetrators, when they'd say, well, I just lost control, he'd say, well, have you ever gotten angry with your boss? Have you ever gotten angry with a cop? And they'd say, yes. And he'd say, have you ever hit them? And they'd say, no. So this is not about a loss of control. This is about power and a desperate desire to control others. So they perpetrate this kind of attack over and over and over again. So from a medical perspective, it doesn't take much to cut off someone's supply of oxygen. You can crush the trachea, the windpipe, with 34 pounds of pressure. The average grip strength of a 65-year-old man is 67 pounds of pressure, almost double what it takes to crush someone's trachea. And you can imagine what it feels like to have someone kneel on your chest, which doesn't take much of anything. Any of us who've had kids or grandkids who've sat on our chest in play can tell you that there's times when that gets a little bit much to tolerate, let alone when someone twice your size is doing it to terrorize you. I personally am a survivor of domestic violence, and this method of control was one of my abuser's favorite techniques. So I speak from deep personal experience on this. I'm not quite as stressed out talking about it as I was a week and a half ago when I told Senate Judiciary that I thought my heart rate was 130. I think it's only about 110 right now, so we're making progress. But I left him 28 years ago. And it still, to this day, comes back when I think about it. I don't wear turtlenecks. When my kids were little, I couldn't have them lie on my chest. And the idea that it only counts as strangulation if someone puts their hands around your throat and restricts your air that way, as opposed to any of the myriad of other ways that people can use to incur the terror that comes from hypoxia, just devastates me. I urge you to do exactly what your colleagues in the Senate did, pass this out unanimously and pass it unanimously on the floor to protect so many others who need us to be their advocates. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you for coming over and testifying once again. And Senator Taylor's already asked all of us to be sure to look at OLIS and see the Senate hearing.
It's very kind of you to allow me to come in off cycle. I appreciate that.
Well, appreciate
thank you very much.
Taking the time to come over. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay, Melissa Erbaum, Sheriff Roberts, and John Wentworth, please. Don't any or just identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Barker, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, my name is John Wentworth. I'm a prosecutor with the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office. I supervise our domestic violence unit. I've done that since 2010. I've been prosecuting domestic violence since 2001. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1562A. My portion that I'd like to share is to tell you a little bit about how the rubber meets the road and why we're here. What I mean by that is I want to talk about what the law is right now, and that is if a person can literally right now strangle their wife by putting their hands around her throat and squeezing as hard as he can until she feels like she can't breathe and could die. And that is a misdemeanor. And what happens in that case is that person will be placed on probation and they'll be put into a batterer's intervention program and they might get some jail and they might get a fine. And if there have been drugs or alcohol involved, they'll get a drug and alcohol package. If that same person commits that same crime with his wife, putting his hands around her throat and squeezing as hard as he can, he will be placed on probation. It'll be a felony this time, but he'll be placed on probation and he'll get some jail and he'll go through a batterer's intervention program just like we've been putting him in the first time. And he'll get a fine, and if drugs or alcohol have been involved, he'll get a drug and alcohol package. And the third time he does that, it'll be a felony and he'll go to prison. The message that we send to the victim, unfortunately, and to the offender by treating this with kid gloves is that it doesn't matter. When you say it's a misdemeanor and what he did to you is just a misdemeanor, it doesn't seem to matter. And when the punishment is continually, we're going to try and work with you and change your behavior, and it doesn't seem to matter. That's why this is so important. It sends a message to everyone involved, to the prosecutors involved, to the judge involved, to the offender, to the victim, to the police, that these crimes are so serious, they're so dangerous, that they are different. How different are they? Earlier this month, I had the opportunity to attend a strangulation institute. I spent 1 week learning about strangulation, nothing but strangulation. At that institute, a number of prosecutors showed us studies that they had done in their jurisdictions correlating officer-involved shootings, that is, people who have been shot by the police and people who have shot at the police, and incidents of domestic violence. There was a study done in California. There was one done in Idaho. And what struck me is in about 60 to 80% of those officer-involved shootings, the person who was involved had a prior history of domestic violence. In 30 to 40% of those same cases, that offender had a prior history of strangulation. Based on public records information, in other words, nobody went back and talked to the offender's spouses and intimate partners and asked, what was your relationship like? These are studies that were done based on newspaper reports, and they were able to identify 30 to 40% that involved strangulation. I became interested in that. I took a look at Clackamas County's statistics. I looked at our last 10 officer-involved shootings exclusively with the sheriff's office. And what I found is that 60% of those cases of officer-involved shootings involved prior incidents of domestic violence. And 30% of them, 30% of the shootings involved men. This is a gendered crime. Men who had strangled their partner. That's how dangerous this is. That's why this is important. That's why what happens to these offenders matters. It's not just within the four confines of the home where these crimes occur. They leach out into our community and they hurt our police officers, they hurt our community. And this is an opportunity for the legislature to say, we get it. We can do something about it. And that's why I'm urging your support for Senate Bill 1562A.
Thank you. I want to just ask you, I don't know if you were here to hear Representative Parrish.
I did.
There was talk about the sixes, which there's a lot fewer people who classify there, removing everybody to five. Do you see that? How do you see that?
If I had my wish list, these would be sixes, to be honest. I'm told that we can't afford that level of protection. And so I came into the room knowing that we have a bill that sets these at fives, and that in my mind, that gets us part of where we need to go. That when I hear that it's fiscally neutral, I'm excited by that, right?
Yes.
But that's not my wish.
Right.
That's not my dream. I think we should be sending the message that these are
as serious as they really are, and they should be treated accordingly.
Hey, thank you very much. Sheriff?
Yes, good afternoon, Chair Barker and Vice Chair Williamson and members of the committee. Just for the record, I'm Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts, and I'm also appearing here today in support of Senate Bill 1562A, also representing Oregon State Sheriff's Association and Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. I've had the pleasure of working with these two individuals over many, many years, and we are all three of us very passionate about everything that we can do to help support survivors. And I so much appreciate the survivors that testified here today and have already testified. I know this bill will save lives. Today we understand that strangulation is really one of the best predictors of future homicide and domestic violence cases. Well, even so, this near lethal violence has been minimized and really misunderstood in Oregon. And as Deputy DA Wentworth said, under the current law, to get the best shot at increasing her safety, a domestic violence victim has to be a mother and then needs to have her child witness it to be strangled before her assault can be charged as a felony. So without the child present, the current law really does devalue her. And even though we know without a without a child, strangulation is a clear marker of the escalation of dangerousness. It's time to make strangulation a felony, to increase safety for all domestic violence survivors, and to hold these offenders accountable for their near lethal violence. I just want you to know, law enforcement, we are working hard to do our part and heighten the awareness about domestic violence and strangulation. Because most strangulation victims do not have visible injuries, it's easy to miss the signs of strangulation, domestic violence investigations. And by the time law enforcement is alerted to the problem, the abuse has often been going on for some time, because abusers are good at using power and control to keep their behavior concealed. To heighten this awareness, law enforcement has come together to produce some five-part training videos series to include one of the most powerful segments, I believe, is investigating strangulation. And we're in the process of pushing that out to law enforcement agencies throughout Oregon. And this wouldn't have been possible to produce those without the Department of Public Safety Standard and Training, the Sheriffs and Chiefs Association. But we are learning one more piece about men who strangle women, and that is, as Deputy DA Wentworth said, they are our cop killers as well in this nation. Research from Alliance for Hope International, an organization that provides strangulation training to medical and law enforcement professionals, conducted a study in 2017 that revealed 33 out of the 44 police officers killed in the line of duty in the U.S. were killed by men with a history of domestic violence in the public record system. Many had a strangulation history against women before they were killed by a police officer. Our law enforcement community knows the reality of this in Oregon. And in 2013, Oregon City Police Officer Robert Lipke was killed in the line of duty on a domestic violence call. Lipke's killer had strangled his partner the week before he murdered Officer Lipke, and again on the morning he fatally shot Lipke. Officer Lipke's widow, Wendy Lipke, testified in Senate Bill 1562 before the Senate Judiciary on the other day. She couldn't be here today, but I have a letter to read to you from Mrs. Lipke. My husband was killed in the line of duty on November 3rd, 2013. Rob was shot while responding to what first responders thought was a house fire. The investigation later detailed the suspect's plan to kill his domestic partner, his neighbor, and ultimately himself. The victim told investigators that the suspect strangled her as she fought for her life. The only thing ended up saving her life was a pepper spray she kept in her pocket. She did this because she had been assaulted by him before and knew that one day he was going to kill her. She always carried the pepper spray because she was always at risk, imagining living in that near life every day. The victim was able to escape, but the suspect went on a rampage. He lit his house on fire, and my husband, Rob, interrupted him as he was trying to break into the home of a neighbor with a clear plan to kill her. The suspect shot and killed my husband within minutes of strangling his girlfriend. I'm now raising his daughter alone, Ziva, who is 4 years old and talks about her dad, who she only knows through pictures. I'm committed to keeping Rob's memory and his legacy alive. I do want anybody to never forget the amazing man Rob was and the sacrifice he made to his community with his life. My husband's killer had a history of strangling women. I later learned that men who strangle police officers often have a history of strangling women. Yet in Oregon, that is only a misdemeanor. How can something so predictive of a man who killed be treated so lightly by the criminal justice system? If Oregon had taken strangulation more seriously, my husband might be here today. In closing, I just want to say thank you for making this bill a priority, and also a particular thank you to Senator Taylor for a resolve to see Oregon join the many other states that have made strangulation a felony. Also, Senator Prozanski, Senator Hansel, and members of the committee for your work on this very important issue. We may never know how many lives this bill will eventually save, but we will know together that we did make a difference. And I have been here several times before testifying on this, and I hope that we can pass this to make it law. Thank you.
Hi, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Melissa Erlbaum, and I'm the Executive Director for Clackamas Women's Services. I submitted my testimony, so I won't go through all of it, but I did just want to comment and say that we need to take this meaningful step for victims. I do not want to walk out of another session telling victims that this is a misdemeanor, and so I urge you to support 1562A and to move this forward and to take this step. It will make a difference to the folks that we serve every day, and my comments are submitted on.
Thank you very much. We have one more person, Joshua Garvin, please.
Mr. Chair, can I also?
Yes, please come on up, Senator. I'm sorry.
I apologize. Again, Floyd Przonski, State Senator, District 4. Two pieces of information I think is very important for the committee to understand. First of all, anyone who's currently sentenced as a felony, as a level 6, this has absolutely no impact on their sentence. They will continue to serve that time that they've already been adjudicated for. The other part I thought was very important to show you how this impact would be for misdemeanors. There will be 79 individuals that would move into the felony rank if we make this change, where on the first time they will be considered a felony instead of going through this precursor with the predicates. I apologize for neglecting to put that on the record when I first spoke.
Okay, thank you. Please, Joshua.
Chair Barker, if I may, again, Kathleen Taylor, State Senator, District 21. I just met Josh now in the audience, and so he's here. He'd like to share with you what happened to him. I did not know him until just now, and we did not invite him, although I'm glad that he's here. And so I'm here as moral support to sit next to him.
My name is Joshua Garvin. I'm from Hubbard. When I was born, thank you. When I was born with cerebral palsy, so the doctor didn't think I was going to make it out of the hospital. At the age of 2, my parents divorced, and at the age of 4 is when I started being abused for the next 10 years of my life, from strangulation to sexual abuse. For the next 10 years of my life, it happened to me from 4 different people. Three of them were men. It happened to me so much as a child where I began to think it was okay, and at the age of 14, the greatest thing ever happened to me. I was arrested because I had committed a crime myself, and I needed help. So for the next 10 years of my life, from 14 to 24, I'm 25 now. I was incarcerated at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility. For the last year, I was here at the Mental Health Infirmary at the Oregon State Penitentiary. During those 10 years, I went through mental health treatment and counseling to try and to try and learn to cope with this stuff. And what I learned was that there's no forgetting. There's no, you can't go back. But as a child of foster care and who'd been through this stuff, I urge for a yes on this bill, because I see, as someone who's been on both sides of the spectrum, you know, I don't know if we can afford to know I mean, it's not, as a 25-year-old, I still deal with this stuff where I go to weekly counseling twice a week to try and learn how to cope. Just walking here from the bus terminal today, I'm scared to be touched by other men. I'm scared to be touched by people in general. And so I just came here today because I want to learn. I'm part of the Young Republicans of Oregon because I want to be an advocate and help people who have these issues. And so I'm just one man, but I didn't want to be the face in the crowd that just listened. I want to be the face that everybody saw that spoke.
Well, thank you so much for doing that. We really appreciate bravery and can see the strong pressure you're under. Really appreciate you being able to come up and do that for us.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1562 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1543.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1543A is a large omnibus bill relating to public safety that has several different sections. The first section of the bill specifies membership in the Batterers Intervention Programs Advisory Committee and requires the BIP standards apply to all genders. There is a -A25 amendment that expands the eligibility of persons to sit on the advisory committee, and the -A25 also specifies that a defendant can receive credit for time served in jail following revocation from an optional probation sentence. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill broadly relate to sexual assault forensic evidence kits, requires the Department of Justice to create informational materials pertaining to what costs are covered by the Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Medical Response Fund, as well as in a technical amendment. There are no amendments addressing sections 2 or 3. Sections 4 and 5 of the bill deal with the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Section 4 requires healthcare service providers to provide the Psychiatric Security Review Board with medical records pertaining to persons within the jurisdiction of the board upon request. Section 5 modifies procedures for returning a person to the state hospital for violation of a conditional release or a change in mental health following the person being found guilty except for insanity. There is a -A26 amendment which pertains to Section 5 of the bill. This amendment specifies that the supervising entity, which is essentially the Psychiatric Security Review Board, is responsible to facilitate reimbursement of reasonable transportation costs incurred by law enforcement agencies executing in order to return a person committed to the jurisdiction of the PSRB. It also requires peace officers acting on these orders to cause the person to be transported to the state hospital or other designated facility. This language allows enforcement, law enforcement to either transport or arrange for other secure transport of the person. Section 6 of the bill modifies the elements and accessions to the offense of unlawful operation to an unmanned aircraft system or drone. Section 7 addresses legislation passed in 2017, which allowed a court to vacate a prostitution conviction if the conviction resulted from the person being a victim of trafficking. Section 7 allows the court to likewise vacate a conviction for a municipal prostitution ordinance. Section 8 addresses inmate transitional funds, which was also part of a statute enacted in 2017. Section 8 prohibits garnishment actions for these funds while in the custody of the Department of Corrections. Section 9 deals with what is sometimes known as swatting. This is when a person makes a false report to law enforcement that results in the SWAT team being deployed. If that deployment of the SWAT team from the false report results in death or serious physical injury to another person, then Section 9 would impose a mandatory minimum sentence of 30 days in jail. Section 10 of the bill makes following recommendations resulting from a risk and needs assessment and general condition of probation following a criminal conviction. Section 11 of the bill permits reduction of a Class B felony possession of a controlled substance conviction to a Class A misdemeanor upon successful completion of probation. There is an A27 amendment that deals with creating offense of threatening to commit a terrorist act. And there is also a -A28 amendment which provides expedited review to the Oregon Supreme Court regarding the constitutionality of legislation enacted in 2017.
I'm sorry if you're waiting for the probationary driver permits. We're not going to have any time to hear any of that. We've got like 11 minutes and people have to be to other committees, so we will just roll that completely over and not hear that today. And we will I'll call Senator Canope. You want to come up on your portion, please? Thanks for taking the time to come over.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss my -827 amendment with you today. Colleagues, as you know, I'm State Senator Tim Canope, Senate District 27, representing Ben, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And we all were horrified again at, you know, another national tragedy with a school shooting. And it just so happens that in the last 9 days, there have been four threats against schools in my particular district. And one of them was very credible. And you know, we've all thought, well, what is it that we can do? And in this particular case, there was a boy who made a threat and to another student, and that student called 911. And the law enforcement acted quickly and went to that boy's home and found the threat credible, arrested the boy. But the only charge that they could come up with, because they couldn't prove that there was a specific plan or intent, was disorderly conduct. And so my district attorney, John Hummel, along with my chief of police, Jim Porter, and my school district have asked me to introduce legislation, which is the -827 amendment, with just one change. It says it's a Class A misdemeanor, but we would prefer that it be a felony. But essentially, colleagues, what we're trying to do is create a crime that fits what is happening, because I don't believe that disorderly conduct is an appropriate charge for a threat, a violent threat to a school and to the kids that go to that school. So as you can see, this basically says that a person expresses an intent to carry out a threat and that a reasonable person would be placed in fear or terror by that threat and believe that that threat was likely to be carried out. And so I know we are late in the session, and I believe in the underlying premises of this bill. I supported the bill in the Senate, but did not have an amendment at that time. And so that is why I'm before you today, and appreciate the opportunity to present this. And if we're unable to act this session, I would like to continue to work on this through the interim and would be pleased to have any of you join me.
Thank you very much, Senator. Appreciate your testimony. Thanks for coming over. Thank you. We'll jump to the psychiatric security piece. Sid Moore, Kevin Campbell, and Doug Barber, please. We have a really crunch for time right
yep.
now.
Oh, yes.
Right. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee, I'm Sid Moore. I am the interim executive director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I will attempt to be brief and perhaps put my comments into writing. But I want to address Section 5 specifically of Senate Bill 1543. The idea is that it clarifies law enforcement authority to transport absconded PSRB patients. That's really where that comes from. To avoid situations in which law enforcement encounters a PSRB patient who has absconded but isn't committing another crime, has not committed another offense, and this clarifies that law enforcement can, on our authority, ask them or transport them to a mental health facility. Sometimes the state hospitals, but sometimes their own placement, and so we don't anticipate this. Placing an undue burden or more of a burden on law enforcement than it currently does. The situation happens very, very occasionally. The trouble is that when it does happen, it has potentially horrible consequences. So for that, in the interest of time, I will abbreviate my comments and leave it at that. But I will be happy to answer any questions the committee might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moore.
And Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Campbell with the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I want to thank Director Moore, because we've worked in partnership to try to work this through, and Council Perez, too, because it was a lot of work to get to where we're at today. I did want to mention two things, and part of this was mentioned already, but it does give law enforcement the ability to make a determination about how they will transport. Secure transport may be the best option, and so I appreciate that there's language there that provides that flexibility, and that also that the department helps to facilitate reimbursement if a department is, in fact, having to transport. In some cases, it might be at quite a distance. But I appreciate the partnership and working to get language that we can that gets us there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs in support of the Dash 26 amendment, which is this PSRB provision in Section 5. The community mental health programs are some of the supervising entities when individuals under PSRB jurisdiction abscond and need to be returned to the state hospital. And as Kevin mentioned, this also helps clarify some of those transport issues. We really appreciate the work of committee counsel to bring everybody together to iron out that language, and encourage you to support the Dash 26 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Sophia, why don't you come on up and we'll run through a few of yours real quick, hopefully real quick. And okay, and is Kimberly still here? Or is
she? She had a meeting.
Okay. Okay.
Chair Barker, my name is, and members of the committee, my name is Mary Sophia. I'm the legislative representative and a recovering lawyer for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm here to offer brief testimony on first the Dash 4, if I may skip to that.
Sure, yeah,
And so that's a fix to the prostitution bill that happened in 2017. It was clearly just an omission, and it's adding municipal ordinance to that. And so we think that's appropriate. We're in support. The Dash 25 is an optional probation fix. Back in 2015, there was HB 2310, and it had made multiple changes. I'm going to direct you to look at testimony from Attorney Jess Barton. He's explained this in long detail, but this is a fix that was just an omission in the law, and so this is truly a fix. And so we're in support of that, and again, I would just direct you to Mr. Barton's testimony. I don't want to speak for my colleagues, but my understanding is that the ODAA is neutral on that. We made sure to have a conversation with them about that before bringing that amendment. The Dash 27, I just want to briefly comment that did get posted right before the hearing, and I heard from Senator Knope that he's open to having a work group. If he is, we would love to participate. Kimberly McCullough with the ACLU of Oregon had to leave, but she had asked me to put on the record for her that because it was posted so quickly, ACLU of Oregon was not able to do a constitutional analysis, and that bill, because it's about a threat and not actually about action, would necessarily need a constitutional analysis. From OCDLA's standpoint, that's also what we're concerned about. We're also concerned about the idea of making making a crime that has no mental state included and is not actually an act but a threat to act a felony. And so that's just not incredibly common in the statutes, and so we'd like to have a further conversation about that. And so for the moment, we're opposed, but would love to sit at a table with the senator and work that out. And then lastly, the Dash 16. Again, this is a fix. It's regarding a statute that deals with a drug possession and whether or not certain levels of drug possession can be reduced to misdemeanors. It's dealing with Class A, Class B, and Class C felonies. In this case, this is, again, truly a simple fix to make it clear to the court that these drugs, Class B and Class C, should be treated similarly as far as being able to reduce a felony conviction to a misdemeanor, either prior to at sentencing or after probation has been completed. So these are all relatively quick fixes. OCDLA is in support, and I just wanted to make a record of that.
Thank you.
If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Okay, thank you.
Aaron Knott, please. And Amanda Dalton.
Okay.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm on about a dozen of these, so if any of you really want to hear from me, follow up, and I'd be happy to chat with you. The one that I want to mention very briefly is the A28s. This is a sort of once-in-a-blue-moon referral that the legislature can make of a court case directly to the Supreme Court, which expedites review and goes around the Court of Appeals. Happens almost never. Here we're talking about House Bill 3078 from last session, which has a real substantial impact on our prison populations. And there are people in various counties that right now are serving different sentences depending on what county they're in. We would like both the civil and any trailing criminal cases to receive expedited review within this window. Again, happy to answer any questions about it. No, we're in a hurry. It's a once in a blue moon thing, but we believe it's appropriate here.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Amanda Dalton on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And while we are not a party to the suit, we do have counties impacted, including one of our largest members being the lead plaintiff in the lawsuit. We did just see the amendment and an hour before committee started. We've had good conversations with Mr. Knott, and I think we're close this afternoon, and we would just ask that this not move today and allow us a little bit more time.
Okay, it's not moving today. So thank you very much. Jeremiah Stromberg, we'll have you real quick, and then we'll call it a day. I'm late for my next meeting.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, Jeremiah Stromberg with the Oregon Department of Corrections, here asking for your support to the Section 8 of Senate Bill 1543. It was the intent that Senate Bill 844 in last session, which created the opportunity for DOC to collect monies from inmates to pay towards restitution, would also protect certain monies from garnishment. That was the intent of the work group. It didn't happen. This is a fix to ensure that there's a transitional fund of monies available as our inmates release back to the community, and we'd ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, any questions? Okay, thank you. So we will be carrying over House Bill 1538 for a public hearing and work session. We are carrying over Senate Bill 1562 for a work session tomorrow, and Senate Bill 1543 for a work session tomorrow. With that, we'll adjourn the committee. Thank you. All right, Senator.